Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today as we visit with Scott Craven, an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Scott will be talking about the latest news on chronic wasting disease, help us maintain our bird feeders. He'll also talk about the first signs of spring. And I hope you'll join in. What do you wonder about CWD? Are there many birds visiting your feeders? Other wildlife questions or maybe experiences on your mind? I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Ideas@WPR.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry, it's great to be back. I'm over here on the shores of the banks of the Mississippi River in La Crosse at the Wildlife Society meeting, and it's a little nippy out, but it's sunny at least. At least the sun's out.
You know, there are a couple of symposium presentations at that meeting. Maybe first tell us what's the genesis or what's the makeup of the Wisconsin Wildlife Society, and then talk about some of the presentations.
Well, the Wildlife Society is our professional organization for people in research and management and education related to wildlife. This is our professional society at the national level, just like the American Medical Association is what doctors belong to. And there's a state chapter, the Wisconsin State Chapter of the Wildlife Society, that was chartered in 1972. And we started off this meeting, which is the first time we've been face-to-face now for 3 years because of COVID. We started out last night with a wonderful 50th anniversary celebration. And yesterday there were two symposia as well that you mentioned. The one was on climate change as related to wildlife, and the other one was on the use of prescribed fire or burning for habitat management. And this will be followed up. We started this morning with a plenary session on decision-making in wildlife management, and there will be dozens more presentations and posters on deer, wolves, game birds, endangered species, songbirds, whatever. All built on the theme of using science to better inform management decisions and actions. So there's a real smorgasbord of material, but there are about 200 people here representing active and retired Fish and Wildlife Service, Wisconsin DNR, university system, consultants, and a variety of other agencies and non-governmental organizations. So it's a pretty cool gathering to see a lot of old friends and a lot of people, a lot of young folks who will be taking over for those of us who have retired. And it's an encouraging and very dynamic thing.
As you think about it, and I'll put you on the spot here a little bit, is there one talk or one thing that kind of stood out maybe for you a little bit above the rest?
Personally, I'm kind of interested in a talk coming up on a 5-year summary of Project Snapshot. You know, we've talked a lot on the radio program about all these literally millions, I think, of photographs that are coming in and how that's being used. I'm interested in that one. But the hot button issues are right now the society's position on the wolf management plan that's out for review right now. And I'll say something about that hopefully a little later, because the public has a couple of good opportunities to comment on that over the next 2 weeks. So the wolf issue is always on the burner. There's always stuff to talk about deer management, particularly as related to chronic wasting disease, as you mentioned in the introduction. And beyond that, it's a real smorgasbord of just about anything that relates to any species or habitat type that you could think of.
You know, on Friday afternoon, I'm going to Lake Geneva to see the national ice sculpting competition, and it's going to be 2 degrees for on Friday afternoon.
Well, enjoy that.
But it reminds me that spring will eventually be here, and it's hard to believe that spring is anywhere close. What are some of the early signs of spring we can watch for?
Well, there are both natural signs, and then there are just things that occur this time of year that are encouraging. For example, I've gotten a couple of my seed catalogs and my garden supply catalogs, and usually when they start coming out at this time in winter, you know that there's hope, that spring is out there somewhere. Additionally, last week I received my turkey permit in the mail. So those are out as well. And that's also a sign that, spring, along with the spring turkey hunting season, can't be that far away. But on the natural front, you know, there are certainly things going on that I've seen around the yard. They're probably more prevalent in the southern part of the state now than in the north that has a heavy snow cover. But the squirrels have started chasing each other around, which is an early sign of breeding activity. And they'll be having their first litters in March. So, again, not that far away. I've been over here for a while. And it's been too cold to be out in the evening, but I assume the great horned owls are probably starting to hoot and set up nesting territories and woodlots around the southern part of the state. And I wouldn't be surprised the next time it gets above freezing if I don't hear a male cardinal singing up in a treetop. We haven't seen anything like any indicator birds coming back from the south. I think last year, I was trying to think back on my records, I think my first red-winged blackbird showed up on March 5th last year. You know, we'll see. But even that isn't that far away. So there's hope, Larry. Spring's coming.
I can't wait for that first cardinal song in the morning. I did hear two days ago when I was out for my 3 mile in the morning jog, freezing to death, a great horned owl hooting right in our neighborhood. And I thought,
there you go.
There's a good sign.
Some of the listeners may be seeing things or hearing things that we're not either. So hopefully they'll call in and tell us what's up.
Yeah, for sure. Well, bird feeding, it's kind of coming up to the peak of bird feeding season, isn't it?
Well, it's important throughout the winter. The birds become pretty regular attendees, not necessarily completely dependent on the feeding, but they certainly utilize it. In my case, I think as I was filling the galvanized barrels in the garage yesterday before I came up here, I realized, boy, I think I'm up to the 500 or 600 pounds of black oil sunflower range for the winter bird feeding season, which is a lot of sunflower seeds, especially since they've gotten a bit pricier over the past couple of years. So, yes, there's a lot of bird activity. In my case, I'm feeding a flock of probably a good solid 50 birds and a mixed flock of goldfinches and house finches, quite a good flock of juncos, some chickadees. The blue jays come every morning for their handful of shelled peanuts. The cardinals are always there as last light disappears in the evening. And in between, the woodpeckers and a few other species are coming and going. But the most interesting thing has been the progression of that covey of quail that I mentioned back in late summer that had turned up and were living in my raspberry patch. And the covey's dwindled over the course of from July to now. But the other day, I flushed, there were either four or five. I didn't get an exact count out from under the deck where they were feeding on spilled seed. And they've been roosting under some of my balsam fir Christmas trees that get bent over in the snow, and the limbs kind of form a little tent-like shelter for them. And I'm going to be very interested to see if any of those little guys make it through this cold spell and are out there to sing in the spring. A whistling Bob White is a really cool thing to hear in the spring. So I'm hopeful. But you're right. The fundamental premise is this is the time of year when people need to keep those feeders stocked, keep them clean, and enjoy the birds that are coming in. It's about the only sign of life out there on the winter landscape and only sign of color. And I think that's what draws people to it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. Scott, do you put water out or maybe just talk about water for the birds?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I had forgotten about the fact that I invested in a heated bird bath a couple of years ago. It was sitting on a shelf in the garage. My wife noted that I have a small stock tank heater in our water garden, in our water feature in the backyard. And that's been struggling to keep a hole open about maybe dinner plate size and diameter. And she says, look at those morning doves. They're every day, they're lined up down there standing in the snow trying to get a drink out of that little hole in the pond that's kept open. I said, holy cow, I forgot about the bird bath. So anyway, I dug that out last weekend and just installed it a few days ago, filled it, put a piece of wood in it so they could perch on something to get water. And I assume now they're happily using the heated bird bath that's put right in amongst the feeders. So, yes, water is important. They use water. Many of them use a source of grit, which they normally get from sanded sidewalks and roadsides and things like that. So that isn't a big deal to add to your feeding repertoire, but certainly the food in the form of whatever seeds you're using, and then a source of water and some cover, and then the birds will be quite happy. The only blemish in the operation, some people view it as a liability, some not, but I forget, we were watching one of the playoff football games, I think, the other day, and all of a sudden, a wham! There was a big whack on the window. I said, what the heck was that? And my wife got up, grandson was there, and they looked out the window, and it was a mourning dove that had hit the window, but it hit the window because it was being pursued by a Cooper's hawk.
Wow.
And the dove had dropped down into the snow, and the Cooper's hawk, right under the window in plain view of everybody, was proceeding to hold it down and pluck it and start to eat it. And that played to mixed reviews among the family members. It eventually flew off with the carcass, and I later found the carcass on the other side of the house quite a ways away. But you know, that's a natural event. Cooper's hawks are another species to add to the checklist of what's coming to your feeders, and providing sunflower seeds for the birds, or for the songbirds, and songbirds for the Cooper's hawk, I guess. And the reality is there's relatively little you can do about that, short of making sure you provide some good escape cover for the birds around your feeders, which is something you do as a progressive thing, not that you can do immediately. Although I do use our discarded Christmas trees to provide some additional cover close to the feeders until spring. And beyond that, you kind of let the show play out. The one thing that troubled me most about that incident was the bird hitting the windows in the first place.
Yeah.
And that's probably a more serious mortality factor to your bird feeding station than the intermittent presence of a predator like a Cooper's hawk. So if you can take some steps to put a hawk silhouette or darken the windows, cover a particularly problematic window with translucent something paper that eliminates the reflection or the idea that that's a passageway for the birds to escape through, then you can usually minimize that problem too. So it's not all roses and whatnot when it comes to bird feeding. You have some responsibilities too.
Somebody sent on my Facebook page, somebody sent a video of a Cooper's hawk flying into several times, I think three or four times, into a fir tree. And, and you know, it was probably after a bird, you know, that was in there, but didn't seem to be successful in that case. It was kind of an interesting video to watch that Cooper's hawk charge into that tree several times.
Well, yeah, it's not always a sure thing that they're going to catch dinner when they start pursuing the birds. So that, you know, people need to change their focus a little bit and think, well, that's kind of cool to watch too. So see how it plays out.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take some calls, but first I just want to remind you that you are listening to Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, and remind you that Clara Neipert's our producer today and Trina LaSousa is our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Scott Craven, our guest today as we talk the world of wildlife, Larry Mueller here, and let's take a call. Tom in West Bend, thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry and Scott, I'm enjoying your program. I just wanted to report to you that I have been hearing a male cardinal singing at about 6:45 in the morning for the last 5 days.
Oh, good for you. I'm usually back to my house by then. I'm usually out there between 6 and 7, and I haven't heard one yet. Oh, isn't it fun?
Run Park, and I'm heading back home, and I heard that male cardinal. I first couldn't believe it, but there's no mistaking it.
There isn't. Tom,
very distinctive call, and I hope Tom tells his bird to call his relatives over around my house to tell them to get off their duffs and start singing.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Matthew in Blue Mounds, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Matthew.
Good morning. We have a farm out here in Blue Mounds, which we purchased in the mid-'80s, and at that time we had quite a nice bobwhite population, and then they kind of just all disappeared. And I was surprised this summer, all of a sudden, a mother and her pulse came tromping through my front yard, and they hung out for a couple of hours, and they left. And I was just wanting to ask Scott about what about the population now. I know they're a ground bird, and they're always in trouble.
Yeah.
Well, the issue, Matthew, glad you're seeing some too. The issue, of course, is that we're kind of right on the edge of their northern distribution, and it only takes one really bad winter, particularly with really deep snow and bitter cold, the kind of thing we're experiencing just the last few days with that heavy snow that came through, and now the sub-zero weather, to make things very difficult for them. And icy conditions, an ice storm is even worse than that. So they have a tough go of it here in this area, but a few seem to make it. How much of that you can consider a natural phenomenon is questionable. There are a few remnant cubbies, and with a series of good winters, they start to spread out a little bit and multiply, which is what people hope for. But there are also some folks being a little more proactive and releasing captive-reared bobwhites to try and augment the very limited natural population and maybe give them a jump start toward populating the area. And that was the source of the birds that I'm watching on my property. The neighbor released 50 of them last spring or early summer. And he gets them from a fellow who's kind of devoted himself to restoring bobwhite to southern Wisconsin and releases many of the birds in different locations around the southern part of the state. And I think you get through to this program by contacting the folks at Pheasants Forever, the local chapter in Madison. And they also have a branch that deals with quail. And I think they could be helpful perhaps in, if you're interested in that and maybe getting some birds to release on your farm, then there are ways to do that. They're also available on the open market, but you need to check out the source of those birds and their health and all before they're just simply released. And you might also want to check with the local wildlife manager to see what they're recommending or if they have a source that they're particularly happy with.
Yeah, well, good points. Matthew, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. You know, you were mentioning the cold and so forth. John emailed us a question. He wonders what kind of vascular system do birds have that permits them to be out in these 20, 30, 40 below wind chill conditions?
Well, they are able to reroute blood supply to keep parts that are exposed suitably warm, like feet, naked feet, for example, or scaly feet. But their major heat conservation is their feather system that they can fluff up and trap air. And essentially what they're creating is the same thing we try and create by using birds' down feathers to insulate our parkers and the things that keep us warm in the winter, because I mean we're flat out naked. Not much fuzz, no feathers, no nothing. So we have to rely on materials either synthetic or natural to keep us warm. But the birds have that advantage through their feathers and the ability to fluff those up and trap some air and so forth. But behaviorally, they also stay out of harm's way when it's really ugly. They're stocking up on food at the feeders, especially in anticipation of a storm, so that they have some food energy reserves. But at that point, then, they're back in as heavy a cover as they can find up against a tree trunk on the opposite side of the wind direction or in some thick vegetation. or in the case of those few little quail around my house in a basically a little snow shelter that they're able to get under in to stay out of the wind. And as I think everybody remembers from their childhood, even if it's bitter cold, if there's deep snow, I remember as a kid digging holes in the snowbanks, and then you'd crawl in there with a couple of your friends and, hey, this is pretty comfortable. I mean, it certainly works for humans living in the far north, and some birds use that strategy too of the protection that a dense layer of snow projects. For example, ruffed grouse, or partridge as some people call them, actually dive or work their way into deep fluffy snow and stay under the snow in times of severe cold. They're actually presumably pretty comfortable, or at least comfortable enough to survive. That's what they care about.
Gary in the town of Ween, thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry and Scott. Great show as always. We have 5 male cardinals and 2 females regularly coming to our feeder. In the beginning, the males spent all their time chasing each other, but now they must have made a truce because we'll have 4 or 5 of them at one time, not doing anything to each other except feeding. But the other day, there was a whole bunch of different birds at the feeder, and they all were gone in just like a blink of an eye. And I looked around, and here in our big maple tree was a sharp-shinned hawk. And it sat there for a while. The birds didn't come back, and then it sort of flew through near the feeder, but there was nothing for it to attack. And about 2 days later, the same scenario took place, but then it stopped by this little apple tree, which is maybe 10 feet from the feeder, and on the other side of the apple tree was a blue jay, and they sort of had like a standoff because the foliage, you know, the branches and twigs in between didn't allow the hawk to go straight at it, and the blue jay was smart enough not to flush.
Well, that's the way the system works, Gary. These birds, the predators and the prey, have lived together for many, 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 many years. And over that time, the prey species have evolved strategies of using cover or being alert and aware and passing the word when there's a predator in the area. Predators have got the advantages in speed and mobility and that kind of thing. So, you know, no predator that's 100% effective is going to survive long because prey disappears. So the system has worked in checks and balances so that we can have some predatory birds and some prey birds. And in the end, it works out.
And in the end, it's a really cool thing to be able to observe, and probably Gary is never going to forget that.
Yep. And he mentioned a sharp shin, and for folks wondering, but well, I said Cooper's hawk, and Gary said sharp shin. They're actually 3 bird-feeding predatory birds that are very similar in appearance, but very different in size. And the sharp-shinned or sharpie is the smallest one, about the size of a blue jay and very streamlined. Then the next one in the middle is the Cooper's hawk. They're the most common one I think people will see around their feeders. And then periodically we'll have goshawks around that are bigger than either of the other two. And they're the ones that move in periodically and prey on ruffed grouse and other birds that are a little bit larger. So that's the way the bird hawk situation shakes out.
Gary, thanks again. Appreciate the call. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Here, you email as well to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Jim in Loganville next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. Yeah, I usually shovel off an area around the feeder and then throw seed on the ground. And the other day I had 53 mourning doves feeding on the ground around the feeder.
Wow. And that's a lot of doves.
Yeah. Also, I've had red-headed woodpeckers at the feeder all winter. They're usually gone in the winter, I thought.
Red, and they're, you're sure they're, well, red-headed woodpeckers are pretty easy to identify. That's really cool.
But I've talked to a couple other people too, and they've had them too. Aren't they usually? Don't they usually migrate?
Well, they're just a scarce bird these days to begin with.
Yeah.
And not considered one of the common feeder woodpeckers, as opposed to say a red-bellied or downy or hairy or whatever. But as Larry said, a redhead is the only one with the whole head bright red, and then the rest of it looks like it's in a black and white tuxedo. All the other woodpeckers have some red on the head, but not a completely red head. So if you're seeing the ones with the completely red head, there's no question about what you have, Jeff.
Yeah.
I mean, Jim, rather.
That's pretty cool, Jim. So, thanks very much for calling us. I don't know what the population is, but it's certainly far fewer of those than the other woodpeckers.
True.
Chris in Black Creek, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, guys. I heard that gentleman from Blue Mound down there, and you guys were talking about the quail and stuff. Now, I know this is a little bit rough, but I was a big hunter years ago back then, and I hunted the north side of the mound, and I would get my limit in grouse, my limit in Hungarians, my limit in quail, and my limit in pheasants. And I can tell you, back then, you'd walk around the corner of the woods, and I had a single shot 20 gauge, and 60 Hungarian partridge would go up off the ground like a shotgun went off. So back then, the population of all four of those species was quite large. I would come back with my bag limits on all. That's all I want to say. I know it's not really part of your show. You're talking about birds, but you know, I was a hunter.
Well, it was a habitat thing. I think plays a big role from say 30 years ago to now, Scott.
Well, there have been lots of changes. I mean, Aldo Leopold used to hunt and have a habitat project, you know, just west of Madison, not far from Verona, and also not far from Blue Mound, where Chris is talking about. And there were certainly lots more quail. Pheasants were kind of just getting underway, but we had a much larger population of native pheasants that wasn't as dependent on stocking as we currently are. And there were certainly grouse in southwestern Wisconsin in large numbers, and there were quail. But for each of those species, the situation is slightly different in terms of why they're either gone or less abundant than they were. And as you mentioned, Larry, the key is that the habitat is very different. Farming practices are very different than what they were. The development that's occurred, you know, anywhere in Dane County and certainly west out into Iowa County and so forth is also very different. And again, some of those birds, like the pheasants, perhaps are maintained more by stocking than by natural habitat. The grouse have disappeared almost completely from southwestern Wisconsin due to habitat change, and that has been well documented by some research from Scott Walter, one of my friends and colleagues from when he was with UW-Richland Center. So the grouse are all but gone, a natural response to habitat change, human pressure, and assorted other things. The Huns have virtually disappeared from southern Wisconsin. The only stronghold for Hungarian partridge, or Huns as they're called, is over in eastern Wisconsin from, say, Green Bay down the Lake Michigan shoreline a ways. Quail we've already talked about, and pheasants, again, have, in terms of native populations, been depleted by habitat change, hunting pressure, and so forth, and are now more dependent on stocking from the DNR's game farm. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of yearn for those days that Chris is talking about, when somebody could go bird hunting and expect multiple species and plenty of birds, but those days are gone. We look back at the good old days in a lot of things, and they're not coming back.
Let's go to Josh in Mauston next. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I guess I was commenting on the woodpeckers earlier the gentleman was talking about. I got a couple, a pair of pileated woodpeckers, the really big ones.
Yeah, pileated.
Yeah, okay, that's how you say it. Yeah, they come, they frequent my backyard a lot and the trees. And I got a bunch of dark-eyed juncos. And I think a Cooper's hawk got one of my dark-eyed juncos in my backyard. But like he was mentioning, the woodpeckers, I have a few species that come, but I put out the suit for them.
Mm-hmm.
I get like three different species of them. I didn't really have a question, but it was just kind of a comment. And I know it started, I had two mourning doves, and I guess, I think they mate lifelong partners. I'm not sure, but it started with two mourning doves, and then I guess over the years, I think their babies kept coming to the same place, and now I get, like, a bunch of them.
Mm.
They kept growing, and they keep coming, because I keep cheating them, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is the kind of results people can expect if they're not experienced feeders but decide to get started and spend a few minutes learning about the proper feeders and feeder placement and what kind of foods to put out. The birds in a given neighborhood will respond very nicely, and that's what people enjoy, are the different species that Josh mentioned and the fact that there's always some activity and sound and color and so forth out there in the winter landscape. So keep up the good work. Most people don't see pileated woodpeckers very often, and they're not a common feeder visitor, but when you see them and you hear their distinctive call, I mean, they're as big as a crow and kind of like the cartoon character Woody Woodpecker. So they're a beautiful bird, but they're not very plentiful on the landscape, and a pair will occupy several hundred acres, but you'll see them coming and going and calling. So
yeah,
enjoy what you have while you have it.
Yeah, you bet, Josh. Thank you for calling. Ann in Janesville, we'll go to you next. Hi, Ann.
Oh, good morning. What I use for a warm or a heated bird bath is I take a large dog water bowl and I set it up on a cinder block so it stays above the snow. And I put a brick in it and some stones so that the birds have, you know, can get down into it. And the other day, I saw house sparrows before I got cold. I saw house sparrows bathing and splashing all over it. And the squirrels just love drinking water out of it, too. So it's just, it's amazing to see the activity around there. And I've also heard, we call them hooters, the great horned owl. They've been hooting every night since mid-December. So it's just awesome to hear that outside the bedroom window.
Oh.
And I saw a pair of red-tailed hawks. I live right in the city of Janesville, a mile from downtown and about a few blocks from Rock River. And we have like a 100-foot tall white pine. And for the last three summers, we've had a pair nesting there. And I just saw one up there in the tree last week. So hopefully they'll be coming back. But it's so much fun watching them teach their young ones to hunt and how to build a nest. We saw them teaching how to build a nest this fall before they went south.
Mm.
So it was awesome.
And thank you. Comments, Scott? Joy of the outdoors.
Yeah, and not so much a comment on what's being done. And I think people understand the basic needs of wildlife in terms of food, water, and shelter. And if you start to think about how you can provide those elements around your home, you can enjoy these things. What I find most interesting in hearing from these folks today is how much enjoyment the people are getting out of the wildlife in their neighborhood. And for those who may be more just passive observers, to realize there are a few simple steps you can take to get the kind of experiences that these people are relating. So, hey, the more the merrier when it comes to enjoying and therefore supporting and being protective of wildlife resources. It's a good thing.
Absolutely. And thanks, Ann. Appreciate it. Stella in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi. I was just calling in about bird baths in the winter.
Yeah.
We give we have a reverse osmosis system in our house, and that's the water that we use in for all living creatures around our house, including the wild bird bath. We tried using a heated bird bath several times over the years we had, and they kept burning out. And so what we ended up resorting to was we got it's either a 3 or a 5 gallon heated livestock bucket.
Ah.
And then we've wrapped it in a quilt, silver quilted, it's a
bubble wrap,
okay. for further insulate it. And we have a cast concrete fountain that we take the top off of it that we use as a bird bath in the summer, or a bird fountain in the summer. But we can't get that. It's not heated. So we take the top off of that, which it has like a little, it looks like a little stream running down a little stream running down from the top to the lower edge of that. We put that on top of the stock bucket and plug in the stock bucket. And we ended up having to put the bird water on a timer and turn it off at night, because when we let it run 24 hours a day, we were getting skunks and raccoons and possums up on our deck.
Oh. Stella, thanks. Well, got a comment?
Well, everybody needs a drink, but I guess the take-home message there is that there are creative solutions to some of these needs that people come up with, again, very creatively, and they get the job done in terms of, again, providing those basic habitat elements that these birds, or in the case of the mammals they don't really want, are looking for out there on the landscape. So
And just a comment on the stock bucket reminded me of a DNR comment about birds. They need deeper water, not shallower water like in the summer. Did you see that comment, Scott?
I did not, and I'm just trying to figure out what that might refer to.
I can't remember.
Deep water, like the I mentioned the stock tank heater in my my water garden, which is, I don't know, 1,500 gallons or whatever. It's when it's operating in the summer with the waterfalls and all, the birds gravitate to the shallow, stony, pebbly areas in the waterfall, or to the edges that I've equipped with angled logs into the water and whatnot, so they can hang on to something and get a drink. But deep water, I guess I'm not sure what the genesis of that comment is, Larry. I mean, water that's over 2 or 3 inches deep can be a death trap to some of these songbirds that get in essentially over their head. And if they get wet and can't get out of it, they end up as a dead bird floating in the pond. So
I'll have to look that up.
I'm not sure.
I'll have to look that up. I will look that up. And I will remind you, by the way, Scott Craven's our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. We're talking wildlife. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Before we go back to the phones, I tried to check on the DNR comments. The one that I see here is that winter bird bathing or so forth, it's deep enough for birds to drink but not bathe in.
Right.
So, well, I don't know where that deep
I don't know what that means, because a bird will try and bathe in a half an inch of water as long as they can splash it around. So I guess I'm not sure what the context is of that. So,
yeah, we don't want deep water where birds could actually get under the water. They'll put it that way.
Right.
Janet in Madison, thanks for joining in. What's on your mind?
Hey, guys. I have two things. First, I'm noticing the goldfinches looking like they're more yellow around their neck, which is giving me a hopeful feeling that maybe spring is coming. Now, is that my imagination, or are you noticing it too? And then the second question is, I did send in a picture of a hawk I came across that was on the ground having some dinner, and I had trouble recognizing who he was. I'm wondering if Scott could take a look at that photo I emailed in.
Scott can try, but I'm on my cell phone in a hotel room in La Crosse and don't have access to my laptop right now, but I'll see if I can scroll through my email and check it out if Clara has sent it to me.
Yeah.
In fact, what I'll try and do, Larry, is check that while you're doing the news at the top of the hour. And
yes.
Then if I get lost, then Clara can call me back.
Yeah, they're good point.
Okay.
All right.
Check it then.
Thanks, Janet. And thanks for the comment on the gold pitches, by the way, too. Glenn in Spooner. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. Nice to talk
Hello.
To you guys.
Yeah, good to have you with us.
I have an observation and then a question about white-tailed deer.
Okay.
One is that the severity index has to be awfully high up here in Spooner since we have a lot of snow on the ground with layers of ice in between some of the snows. So it's pretty hard going. I haven't walked out now away from my driveway for a couple of months. Since before Christmas, it's been building up this way. So we have quite a tough situation for the deer herd here.
Okay. The comment is that the first information I'd seen on that was a week or two ago in the DNR weekly update that the severity index was creeping up. That requires, for people not familiar with it, a day that has more than 18 inches of snow on the ground gets a point, and a day that's below zero gets a point, and then those points are accumulated. You can get up to two a day, and then there's a scale that's referred to as the winter severity index, and when it gets to a certain point, it's keyed to likely percent loss, in other words, mortality in the deer herd. And I think it's when it's considered severe, it gets up to close to 100. And I don't know where it is now. It varies, of course, by location. But the DNR folks are monitoring that. And not that we can do anything about it, but it does inform us as to what the likely problems are that that's going to cause. So hopefully the weather moderates a little bit and it doesn't get too much worse. The layers of ice interspersed in the snow depth are even more problematic because smaller animals have trouble getting through that for food. And that also makes it difficult for what I mentioned earlier with the rough grouse trying to snow roost in deep, fluffy snow. That can't happen if there are layers of ice. So
yeah.
Anyway, just another sign that winter is a tough time of year.
Yeah, and Glenn's in Spooner, so that's pretty far north. So I know there's been lots of tough weather conditions up there in many parts of the north. Thanks, Glenn. Appreciate it. Bill in Portage, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Bill. How you doing, guys? I've been a birder most of my life, but I saw something very interesting this fall, September. And it was a nighthawk migration. It was later in the afternoon in front of a storm coming in. At first, there were just a few birds flying around, but about a half hour later, things thickened up a little bit, and there were a few more. But then about an hour into it, there was a swarm of birds. It was like a bee swarm, and there were thousands of birds. And you could walk into the swarm, and they would swoop down, just barely miss you. And it was unbelievable to see. They passed in about an hour, but I've never seen anything like it, and it was pretty interesting migration, pretty cool to see.
Yeah, when was that again, Bill? What time of the year?
It was early September.
Early
just
September.
Off the Wisconsin River, and I don't know if they were coming in for insects or what. It was down by a pond, but they just got thicker and thicker and thicker, and it was amazing. It was so cool.
Oh.
That is pretty neat. Birds don't all migrate the same way. It's not like they all, they either go in small groups or individually or whatever. There's a variety from the V-shaped flocks we see of geese to birds that migrate at night, birds that migrate during the day, birds that migrate in huge flocks. But some of the birds like nighthawks and some of the raptors and so forth migrate in these swirling, circulating pods or flocks of birds that are sometimes called kettles, and they slowly move. They work their way south, but they're not necessarily flying in a direct line, either feeding or milling around on the way. And it is pretty spectacular to see some of those things.
Yeah. And a couple of people have emailed about robins. Bonnie in Milwaukee has a flock of them eating in her crabapple tree this morning. Matt in La Crosse emailed. He's heard on the show before that robins will sometimes stay in Wisconsin for the winter instead of migrating. And he and his girlfriend saw a robin in La Crosse yesterday. So they're both wondering, you know, how common is it for robins to stay all winter?
Well, it's pretty common, and the more mild the winter, the more common it is. And there are also, over the years that I've continued to hear reports about this, there are some hot spots in the state, some over along Lake Michigan, which tends to create its own weather. La Crosse is often mentioned as a spot where these birds, perhaps with access to, you know, parts of the Mississippi that may have a little open water. And it's also common to see flocks of robins in the Arboretum in Madison associated with some of the springs and so forth around Lake Wingra. So everybody's right in this situation. Some robins do remain in Wisconsin for all or most of the winter. And why some decide to do that and others don't, most don't, it remains one of those mysteries of nature. But yes, there are spaces or places where the birds apparently have access to what they feel they need through open water or springs or whatnot, and they stay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, robins are seen throughout the year in some parts of the state. Same with some other species. I've seen bluebirds in the dead of winter occasionally. And so this is another reason why, for the people feeding birds, that you keep a variety of things on hand, because some of these birds that aren't nested like robins, that either if they come back too early or have stayed all winter and get really in a tight spot because of poor weather, that there are things that they may eat, like special seed mixes that have chopped fruit in them, or mealworms or other things that some of these birds will take that in place of the standard sunflower seeds or millet or cracked corn or whatever, that they won't usually consume.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But it does surprise people to see, oh, a robin. It must be the first robin of spring. No, it's the robin that stayed behind when everybody else left.
Lucas in Jefferson, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Larry. So my topic was just about a comment and kind of like a question at the same time. I know that we've been discussing the upsides of bird watching and home bird feeding, but there are some downsides with that too, as a previous caller was talking about woodpeckers going to their feeders and everything. Not sure what type of house he had, but I have had damage to my house from woodpeckers, and I'm not sure if it's due to neighbors feeding birds and attracting them or whatever, but I just wanted the conversation to include some downsides to this bird feeding in backyards that can cause neighbors damage or even your own damage to your own house.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the question would be, what are some proven methods to deter this and maybe just hone in on one type of bird and try to get those nuisance birds and other terms, I guess you could say.
Okay.
Wow, that's a really interesting question, Larry, and I'm glad it came up. But I see we're getting close to the top of the hour, so I'll try and cover this, but we might have to come back to it. The situation is bird feeding is you know, widely recognized as a very popular human interaction with wildlife, and is considered, you know, because people get so much joy out of it that, hey, it's a great thing to do. But when you really come down to asking people why they're feeding birds, you know, most people, if they're honest about it, just say, well, gee, I like to have the birds around during the winter. It's not necessarily because, gee, they need a winter food supply, or I'm trying to do something for population management or what have you. Those may be benefits, to be sure, but people are often motivated by
things that interest them. That doesn't mean that there aren't some downsides. I mentioned keeping your feeders clean as being one of your responsibilities as an avid bird feeder. That's very important because you don't want to be spreading or facilitating the spread of any of the common diseases that may be transmitted from bird to bird through droppings and accumulated seed waste and that kind of thing. So that's one downside that Lucas mentioned. Another is concentrating these birds somewhat artificially, making them easier prey for the hawks that we've been talking about. And, you know, there are others too. For example, you attract a lot of birds and all of a sudden, oh, time for us to go to Florida for a month. That becomes a problem too. But we might want to pick this up because the woodpeckers is a special case for house damage. So.
Yeah, we can talk about that in just a few minutes, as a matter of fact. Right now, we are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be back with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. So you stay with us. We've got lots more in store here on the show right after this look at the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. No classified documents, President Biden's personal attorney says. The Justice Department found nothing with classified markings during its hours-long search of his client's vacation home in Rehoboth, Delaware. But Bob Bauer says the DOJ has taken custody of some materials and handwritten notes that appear to relate to Biden's time as vice president. Classified documents were previously found at former President Donald Trump's Florida estate and more recently at the Indiana home of former Vice President Mike Pence. Former U.N. Ambassador and South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is expected to launch her 2024 presidential campaign, making her the first major Republican to challenge former President Trump, Haley's old boss. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reports a source familiar with the Republicans' plan says the announcement's coming in 2 weeks.
Haley has been teasing a run in recent weeks. Speaking to Fox News' Brett Baer in January, she said the nation requires new leadership on a range of issues, like foreign policy, the economy, and the role of government.
All of these things warrant the fact that, yes, we need to go in a new direction. And can I be that leader? Yes, I think I can be that leader.
Haley served as UN ambassador under Trump. She initially criticized him sharply for his role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, but backtracked months later, saying the GOP needs Trump, and at one point she said she wouldn't run for president if he ran. Haley plans on announcing her 2024 run on February 15th in Charleston, South Carolina. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
The Federal Reserve is winding down its two-day meeting and is widely expected to raise its key interest rate again by a quarter percentage point, the highest level in 15 years. It's part of the Fed's aggressive inflation-fighting strategy. The rate hikes make it more expensive to borrow and pay down debt, such as credit cards. Well, the Biden administration is now announcing plans aimed at curbing what it says are excessive credit card late fees. NPR's Asma Khalid reports it's the latest move in the president's agenda to boost competition.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is proposing a new rule to curb credit card fees. Brian Deese is one of the president's top economic advisors.
This rule is projected to reduce the typical late fee that a credit card holder might pay from roughly $30 to roughly $8.
The rule also seeks to cap late fees at 25% of the required minimum payment. The Biden administration hopes to finalize this rule by the end of the year. The president is also calling on Congress to pass legislation to crack down on so-called junk fees, which, among other things, would ban airlines from charging fees for parents to sit next to their young children. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 355 points. You're listening to NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 12:04. I'm Alex Crow. Summer may feel far off, but a recent heat mapping campaign found hotter nights in heavily developed areas of Milwaukee during sweltering summer days. Danielle Kading reports.
Last summer, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources coordinated with groups and agencies in Milwaukee to measure extreme heat. On two hot July days, around 40 volunteers collected data on temperature and humidity every second for about an hour during the afternoon, morning, and night. The DNR's Stan Buckler says findings show densely developed areas stayed about 10 degrees hotter at night.
In those parts of the city which had fewer trees, fewer green spaces, and more asphalt and concrete, they tended to keep being hot into the evening.
Buckler says the city's downtown, east side, and lower south side experienced the hottest temperatures. The findings will guide efforts to add trees and green spaces. Climate scientists say that will be key as Milwaukee and the state are likely to see more days with extreme heat by mid-century. Daniel Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A lawsuit filed by criminal justice advocacy groups seeks to block two Republican-sponsored measures from appearing on the April ballot. The suit argues that they were not submitted on time to the correct elections officials. One question is a proposed constitutional amendment that would allow judges to consider more factors when setting bail for violent offenders. The other is an advisory referendum that asks voters if they believe that able-bodied, childless welfare recipients should be required to look for work. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Carla Itzkovich, whose gift, in memory of Moises Itzkovich, founder of the Moises Itzkovich Foundation, helps provide public radio news and information to communities around the world, and the Lemelson Foundation.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, hosting a conference about wetland management and care, February 21st through the 23rd in Stevens Point. More at wisconsinwetlands.org/conference.
Whether you laugh along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or feed your mind with To the Best of Our Knowledge, you'll always find something to enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find our program schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today with our guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Scott, as we broke for news, Lucas and Jefferson had talked about a kind of a downside of bird watching. And one of the points we didn't really cover is, or we didn't have time to cover, was woodpeckers that start attacking maybe your house.
Yes, and that's a problem that's been around for many, many years. I used to deal with it regularly when I was actively working, and some home sidings, particularly any type of wood siding, are vulnerable to that. Obviously, aluminum or vinyl siding or a brick wall is relatively resistant, but in some cases, there was damage even to window moldings from some woodpeckers that would chisel away at those. But the real issue were woodpeckers that attacked open siding, either to excavate holes or a series of holes to find food items, as was the case with insects that often got into a plywood siding problem, a material called T111 siding that had little interior tunnels under the surface veneer that bugs packed into, and then the woodpeckers would drill a whole series of horizontal holes to get at those bugs. Very destructive and very expensive and problematic to fix. Occasionally birds would excavate a larger hole and actually throw out the insulation and excavate a chamber that they would enter potentially for nesting, roosting, whatever. Either way, they were very annoying to the homeowners and very difficult and expensive to fix or solve. And in some cases, that could easily have been facilitated by either the homeowner attracting large numbers of woodpeckers through feeding or a neighbor. And that, again, is just a downside to the operation. The solving of those siding problems is a little complicated, and there's a UW Extension publication on the matter and lots of internet resources. So I guess I would urge anyone who's still facing that situation to check into it that way and see what kinds of solutions they can find that they might actually be able to use, including scare tactics, exclusion through netting, insect treatment, and assortment of other things. So Sure. There are some downsides, as we talked about earlier, to feeding. But on balance, this is such an important interaction with wildlife, with therefore spin-off benefits for wildlife conservation in general, that feeding continues to be a big business and very popular and very much promoted. Yeah. But it pays to be aware of the downsides.
And again, Lucas and Jefferson, thanks for that call and comment. Mary in the town of Lebanon, we go to you next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was going to say, I'm feeding over 200 birds. But my husband has put a conservation easement on our land, and we have 15 acres of prairie. I'm in the floodplain of the Rock River, so the only problem is with all the flooding, much of our woodlands have died. But last summer, mm-hmm. I did end up with a pair of red-headed woodpeckers, and they did have two young, and so on. So,
they're out there. Of course,
yes, they are. And I was surprised because we've been watching birds here a long time, and my husband kept track of, we have 146 species that have been identified here. And wow. So I was surprised to see the red-headed woodpeckers. But then my husband did a lot with, you know, we have a windbreak, and he made brush piles, and what do we have, those flowering crab trees that the birds like. And so there's lots of habitat here for everybody.
Oh, that's
well,
great, Mary.
It appears that you've done it right, and it's paid off with some unusual birds like red-headed woodpeckers.
And here you've got 146 species. That's about half the species that reside in Wisconsin. We've got about 300, aren't there? Yeah.
Yep. Well, and there are some more that migrate through or incidentals, but that's a pretty good species list, no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it. Nancy in Ridgeland, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Larry and Scott.
Hi.
I'm out walking on a trail right now, which is lovely, way up here in northwestern Wisconsin. But I just caught the end of the part where you were talking about the deer die-off and, the hard conditions up here. And I wanted to share something that I came across this year on a friend's property, and that was blue deer urine. And I had never seen it before, and so I called the DNR, and they said that when conditions are really shaky for deer eating things, they will sometimes eat the buckthorn, and the buckthorn causes some kind of a chemical reaction and causes the deer to have blue urine. So although we don't see it all that often, when you have the kind of conditions we have this year with the really deep snow, it's up over my knees, and also the severe cold, that they will, you know, like on a buffet table, you eat the broccoli last, and, they eat that when they're really in need. So the deer are in need this year, and if anybody sees it, it looks like you poured some antifreeze solution or something in the snow. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Nancy, thanks for that call, Scott. Good call there.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting observation in natural history. It does happen, and it's I've seen it around my property with rabbits as well, and it just results in a blue urine spot, which is, wow, that's weird, and that's the explanation.
Yeah.
But I just want to correct that the winter severity index is growing. I don't know that it's reached a severe level where we'd expect any substantial deer mortality yet, but it's a long way to spring. Well, actually, we'll find that out tomorrow, won't we?
Yeah.
Isn't tomorrow Groundhog Day?
Yeah, isn't it? February 2nd?
Yeah, February 2nd. I think it's Groundhog Day tomorrow. So this is the one time of the year when our lowly woodchuck gets a little respect, and everybody watches to see what happens when one of the celebrity woodchucks is dragged out of their cage to see if they see their shadow or not. So we'll stand by for a winter report tomorrow from the woodchuck community.
All right. Nancy, thanks again. I really appreciate your comment. Well, I like them all. Kevin and Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Yes, good afternoon, Larry. Always look forward to your discussions with Scott. I know this robin situation was brought up, but in the last 5 days, I have two hackberry trees that have been totally cleared off. And, of course, two heated bird baths that are quite messy and have to be filled about three times a day. I just wondered if these are early migration. I've never seen this amount of robins
at this time of year, and a lot of winter left.
Yeah.
I don't think they're early migrants, because actually the weather has been even more wretched to the south of us in terms of, and there's snow cover, I mean, well down into central southern Illinois and further down. So I don't think there's any early spring pressure on birds in the south to be starting to work north when they usually follow the freezing line. So I suspect these are birds that have hung around, and they're simply marauding around the countryside looking for food sources. And that's usually this time of year found on trees or shrubs that have persistent fruits that stand up to freezing and are still out there. And that's what happened with your hackberries. It happens with high bush cranberry bushes. It happens with mountain ash trees. There was one other one I was just thinking of that escapes me. But those kinds of things are an important habitat component, because the birds tend to leave them alone for whatever reason until the going really gets tough in midwinter and they're the only game in town. And then all of a sudden they become very important to these birds. So I suspect that's what happened in the case of your hackberries.
Yeah.
So,
Kevin, thank you.
Good thing they were there.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks again. Dean in Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Dean.
Well, good morning, Larry, or good afternoon, Larry and Scott. Really enjoying the program, but I want to tell you what a bad omen you are. I'm looking out my window here. I got about 15, 16 different species of birds feeding, and as you were talking about Cooper's hawks, bam, right through the yard. I'm a Cooper's hawk.
Oh, that's a little freaky.
It is a little freaky. Although everything just disappeared in a hurry, and it moved on quite quickly. But one of the things I wanted to mention, because people are talking about woodpeckers, and I've been doing this for 30 some odd years as well, I have a flicker coming, and this is the first time I've ever had a flicker in the wintertime.
Wow.
Little odd to me. I have the Harry's, Downy's, redheads, and red bellies, of course. But flicker is a little odd, and he's actually feeding on the peanut feeder.
Huh.
And then the other bird that a friend of mine has coming, she's about 50 miles from where I live, but she has a rufous-sided towhee coming to her feeder, and has for the last 2-3 weeks.
Hmm.
Wow.
So
that's pretty
well,
cool.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that keeps people interested. Not only the masses of relatively common birds that are there every day, but the chance that you're really going to see something strange and then get to ponder, what the heck's going on here? What was this flicker thinking? That's a flicker's a new one on me. So's the towhee, actually. But I mean, the point is you just never know. Were they injured during migration and they've come around now to the point where they're looking for food and trying to tough it out? I don't know. But it's what keeps things interesting in watching the feeders.
Dean, thank you so much. Josh in Mauston called, couldn't stay with us, but he just wanted a comment. You can get an app that can help ID birds. It's called Merlin, and that's a pretty good app, I think.
Yep, there are lots of them, Larry. I mean, everything. The real situation between Google and assorted other search engines and all the apps that are available, it has become so much easier for people to find the information they're seeking. I mean, glad they still call us and ask questions, but there are many other ways in the interim between when we happen to be on, there are many other ways to glean the information people are looking for.
Ann sent us an email, and she said we should please Google Acopian bird savers, Acopian like A-C-O-P-I-A-N. If you don't know about these wonderful things, you should. They are strips of wood with holes drilled in them every 3 inches and hung with parachute cord. Her house is almost surrounded by water and has windows on all sides, and these work wonderfully to prevent birds hitting the glass. You don't want to buy them. The site comes with do-it-yourself instructions. Ann built her own, and it was easy. she's very quick to get used to, she says very quickly they get used to their appearance and now regard them not only as bird savers, but also as attractive window treatments. Acopian wow. bird savers.
Well, I've written that one down. I'm going to have to check it out myself, Larry. It's anything new in that situation of preventing window bird collisions is a good thing, because everything that I've used has some limitations to it. So, hey, if this is something new and different and it works, that's fantastic.
Absolutely. And you can make your own if you don't want to buy them. So there you go.
Well, on the subject of good advice, Larry, before we run out of time here, I just wanted to mention the people have been very interested in the draft wolf management plan.
That's yes. out.
And I just wanted to be sure that folks listening realizes that, the public comment period, if you want to weigh in on the wolf plan, runs until the end of February. But there's the DNR's added a special virtual public listening session through Zoom scheduled for Tuesday, February 7th, this coming Tuesday. And you have to register by the 6th if you want to speak. But anyone who wants to just kind of listen into a live feed can do that on the DNR YouTube channel. So the information in terms of getting involved in that program next Tuesday is all on the DNR website under the Wolf Plan. And in the meantime, then people also have a chance to review the plan if they haven't and get their comments in by the end of February. And there's been lots of talk about that here at the meeting. So anyway, just wanted to make sure people realize they had that opportunity still.
Absolutely. And, you know, Flickers just came up in the comments, and Christine sent us an email. They've lived in Campbellsport for 3 winters, and they see the northern flicker for a few weeks each February. Wondered if they were just passing through to somewhere. That's in February.
Huh.
That's strange.
Well, I can't imagine where they'd be going to or from, because every place nearby is cold and not very hospitable. But again, you know, that's the kind of thing we're able to share when a whole bunch of people are keeping their eyes open and pass on this information.
Yeah, John and Matt.
I've certainly, all I can say from my experience is I've never seen a flicker around my feeders in the dead of winter. So.
There we go. John in Madison emailed us a picture. He says last May his wife Rachel took this picture of a chucker under their backyard feeder in Madison.
Well, that I can understand, because there are, chuckers are a partridge. It's a western bird, you know, frequenting, you know, mountainous and rocky terrain and so forth. But they're widely used in the shooting preserve industry and in dog training. So
yeah.
I would guess that that's a bird that if there's a hunting club or shooting preserve somewhere nearby, got lucky and is now out on the landscape trying to find whatever it needs. And this year in particular, with big shortages in the pheasant trade, in other words, shooting preserves that rely on stocked pheasants are having trouble finding birds, because a lot of bird raisers were impacted by avian influenza and had to depopulate or essentially kill their flocks. With pheasants in short supply, the preserves are turning to chuckers. So there's probably even more chuckers around than normal this particular year. So there you have it.
Dave in Janesville has a comment for us. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I just wanted to verify, we've got a resident robin population all winter, as well as a small flock of bluebirds that have been hanging around. The area has a lot of hackberries and a lot of seeds on them. So
yeah,
they're getting by just fine.
All right. Wow.
There you go. The information, the data continues to pile in, Larry.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate that call. Beverly emailed us. She's been feeding woodpeckers in her yard for many years, the downies, the hairies, and the red-bellied. And last spring, before she was aware, one of them drilled a large hole through her wood siding and into her attic. Then it, or some other bird, built a nest of sticks along the attic wall. She removed the sticks and filled the hole, and then strung some streamers on that side of the house over the hole. but fears they'll start again. The damage is not small, and it must have been a pretty large hole. I don't know where she's emailed from, but
I probably, over the years, probably responded to hundreds of woodpecker damage complaints, and I think on less than a handful of occasions, the birds actually went through the outer wall or siding, then the insulation, whatever it was, and then the interior wall or drywall to actually get in the building. Only two or three times that I can remember, and here now I can add one to the list. But that's pretty unusual, and that requires it probably won't happen again. But if it were me, I'd be filling the hole with whatever was necessary to maintain the structural and insulation integrity. And then for an area on the outside where the hole was and a pretty good, you know, few square feet around it, I'd cover it with some screening or wire mesh. So that couldn't happen again in the short term.
And Sandy in Oneida, you mentioned avian flu, and she's wondering if there's an update on avian flu. She took her feeders last year down because of the outbreak.
I haven't heard that much about it yet. My personal index is the price of eggs. And they're still holding at about $6 a dozen. So I'm assuming the situation hasn't gotten much better or the chicken flocks haven't repopulated yet. Yeah. But in terms of wild impacts, I think that particular outbreak is on the downturn.
Scott, you're leading a tour, or you also lead a tour in Yellowstone. Is that all set up now, or...?
Yeah, there are two tours, actually, that you let me talk about on the air, usually in the summer when we're trying to populate them. One's to Yellowstone in winter, and the other one's to the Everglades. Everglades was canceled because of the hurricane damage from Hurricane Ian, and with good reason. I was just down there 2 weeks ago scoping out the areas we visit, and some of them are just flat-out gone. Others were badly damaged, and some came through relatively unscathed, so... I think folks are going to be able to rebuild and recover, and I hope the Everglades tour is back online next winter. The Yellowstone tour leaves 3 weeks from Monday, and I'm all geared up. I've started to pile up my warm clothes, and we're getting excited about getting out there and seeing the bison and the elk and whatever else we can find.
Yeah, and that's how many people usually typically go on that tour?
The capacity of the Yellowstone tour is limited to only 14 because that's the capacity of the snow coaches that we travel with throughout the park. It's the only means of, other than snowmobiles, it's the only means of transportation on most of the roads. So it's a small, cozy group. We get to know each other very well and have a good time at the Snow Lodge at Old Faithful and visiting some other sites in the park. The scenery is spectacular and wildlife's pretty visible.
And probably not as many people.
Oh, no. It's very... I go out and stand on the boardwalk around Old Faithful, and I know where the webcams, the Forest Service, or the Park Service webcams are up in the trees, so I call home and say, hey, dial up the Yellowstone or the Old Faithful webcam, and I'll wave to you. And then everybody watches me standing there. I've been out there a couple of mornings when I'm alone. And that doesn't happen in the summer. So, anyway.
On that note, we're done. Scott, thanks so much. Really appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Take care. Talk to you all later. Bye-bye.
Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. He'll be back in a couple of months. We'll do it all over again. Next month, David Drake and Jamie Knack are back on the first Wednesday. Tomorrow... the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, you know, receives tens of thousands of requests for help through complaints, and we're going to go over common complaints from last year. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.